On this episode of War Docs, we speak with Dr. Peggy Knutson, a trauma surgeon and the medical director of the Military Health Service Strategic Partnership with the American College of Surgeons. Peggy discusses her background and interest in medicine, her experience in the military-civilian partnerships, and the future of trauma care. Dr. Knutson shares her journey from growing up in a small town in Minnesota to becoming a trauma surgeon and the impact of her experiences as a senior visiting surgeon in Iraq and at Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany and how it impacted her civilian practice. Dr. Knutson emphasizes the importance of the military-civilian partnership in preserving and sharing the lessons learned from military trauma care and maintaining skills to provide expert care in future conflicts. She also highlights the Excelsior Surgical Society, a professional organization for military surgeons, as a valuable resource for networking and continuing education. Find out more about Dr. Knutson and our previous guests on our website, wardocspodcast.com. And make sure you follow War Docs on your preferred podcast platform and subscribe to our War Docs YouTube channel. I'm your host, Dr. Doug Soderdahl, retired Army urologist, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Wayne Causey, active duty vascular surgeon.
Welcome to War Docs, the military medicine podcast. This show brings you a firsthand, behind-the-scenes look into the mission, unique opportunities, and deployed experiences of the entire military healthcare team. From state-of-the-art hospitals in the United States to the most austere environments across the globe, War Docs has you covered.
Today, we're privileged to welcome trauma surgeon Dr. Peggy Knutson to War Docs. Peggy, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's my privilege.
Dr. Knutson, the focus of our interview is discussing your critical leadership in helping to develop military-civilian partnerships in collaboration with the American College of Surgeons. But before we dive into that, let's discuss your background. You went to college at the University of Dayton and medical school at the University of Michigan. Tell us about your background and what sparked your interest in medicine.
I grew up in a very small town in northern Minnesota where my father worked in the iron ore mines. And one of the programs that allowed doctors to come to northern Minnesota was some of the public health programs where people could erase their medical school debt by coming up north and taking care of us. And I was lucky enough to have a pediatrician that was a woman through that program. And so early on in my life, I recognized that women could be doctors, not traditional at that time, but it always was in the back of my mind that maybe that's what I should do. And then when I got into college, I was fortunate enough to work in the biology department. I was fascinated by biology, particularly interested in genetics and DNA at the time. And one of my professors had a research grant, and he hired me to be his research assistant. And I worked for 3 years to work my way through college in a research lab sponsored by the American Heart Association. I still wasn't convinced that I should go into medicine until my last year of college. And I was working in the lab, and I had been working on this experiment for almost 3 years. And I was working on making an antibody to cardiac muscle as a sort of a pre-cardiac transplant experiment. And I finally got the experiment to work. And it was late at night, and I was in this big engineering department where the little cardiac muscle was mounted on a strain gauge, and we put the antibodies on it, and it actually stopped working, which was exactly what we were trying to promote. And I looked around the lab, and there was nobody in the lab but me. And I thought to myself, is this really how I'm going to spend my life, doing research with nobody there to benefit from it except myself? And so I went to my advisor, and I said, I think I should go to medical school. And he looked at me and said, are you crazy? You have a full PhD ride at the University of Michigan. You haven't taken the MCATs. You haven't prepared, except you have all the prerequisites, and it's really late to apply. And I was very, very lucky to be able to squeak into the University of Michigan Medical School because I already had the PhD assigned to me. You know, I got into to medical school, and probably what I should have done all along, it just took me a while to realize it.
So you then did a general surgery residency at Beth Israel Deaconess and University of Michigan, followed by a fellowship in pediatric surgery at Stanford. Why did you choose surgery, and specifically, what led you to pediatric surgery?
You know, when I was a medical student, we got to rotate through different specialties. And at the time I was working in the research lab, again, only this time I was working on hormones in reproductive biology. And I thought, well, OBGYN would be the natural thing. And my third year rotation, I rotated on OBGYN. I said, nope, this is not for me. And then I tried every other rotation, and surgery just kept sticking. There were not very many women in surgery at the time, so it was not really an open field, but I kept looking at it and thinking, this really is what I wanted to do. And then I tried to find a specialty where I thought women would be welcome. I liked kids, but I wasn't going to be a pediatrician. And so pediatric surgery really sparked my interest. And I was very fortunate to come to Stanford to be able to do that extra year as a fellow in pediatric surgery. When I got to Stanford with this idea that I was going to go and be a pediatric surgeon, at the time I got there, the law had just been passed in California that allowed ambulances to bypass hospitals if they had the capabilities for trauma. That was brand new, because remember, I mean, you probably don't remember because you're young, but it used to be that emergency services had to go to the nearest hospital. The American College of Surgeons was just at the time looking at capabilities of hospitals and recognizing that to be a trauma center, you had to have certain things ready to go at all times. And so the California law had just been passed that it would allow the medical ambulances in Santa Clara County, where Stanford's located, to bypass hospitals that weren't designated as trauma centers. And so I was pretty vocal about what you needed to have to be a trauma center, because when I was at University of Michigan, we rotated through Detroit. Detroit Receiving Hospital with Anna Ledgerwood and Charlie Lucas. I went there and worked with them for a while. And we had another hospital in Detroit. So I was really familiar with trauma. So pretty soon I found myself on these committees to look at the trauma system in Santa Clara County. And I became somewhat outspoken in what you needed to have to be a designated trauma center. I took a little curve in my path and decided that trauma was maybe the best fit, and particularly since I had the interest in pediatrics, that I could take care of both adults and children if they were injured.
So you spent that time both at Stanford and the University of California, San Francisco, and at San Francisco General Hospital. During the next several decades of your career, tell us about that practice during those times and what it was like as the trauma system evolved.
I helped Stanford and the other two hospitals in Santa Clara County to go through their official designation through the American College of Surgeons. But the true leaders in trauma surgery at the time were at the Zuckerberg, now called Zuckerberg, San Francisco General Hospital. And I kept sneaking up there to do grand rounds with them and to learn from them. And at the time, it was Dr. Blaisdell, Dr. Trunke, Dr. Lim, some, the really, really important people in the trauma world at the time. And so I kept sneaking up there for grounds. And then finally, they offered me a position at the San Francisco General Hospital. I went up there, and what I was told really remarkably in my letter of assignment, what my schedule was going to look like. And it said, Monday is your operating day, Tuesday is your clinic day, Wednesday is your ICU day. And I realized that I was going to be not just a trauma surgeon, but I was going to have a full general surgical experience, including elective surgery. And I think that's very, very important, because if you just do trauma, you can burn out quickly. It's a very demanding field. There's a lot of moral distress that goes along with being a trauma surgeon. And I think that if you can do general surgery as well, especially elective general surgery, not just emergencies, you're a better technical surgeon. You have the time to be able to slow your operation down. You have the nurses get to know you. They know your priorities. You can teach. You can allow residents to do cases because you're not in a hurry. And I think that's been really important for me. I guess the second thing I would say is that I'm only the second woman to ever work at San Francisco General Hospital. Now, we have more women than men. But at the time, I was only the second one to work there. But I was treated incredibly well, both at the San Francisco General Hospital and UCSF in particular.
So in 2014, you became the medical director of the Military Health System Strategic Partnership in the American College of Surgeons. We'd love to discuss that further, but before we do, could you give us some history of military strategic partnerships?
I think it's important to understand that military surgeons were sometimes not well respected when they came back from particularly Korea and Vietnam, because especially Vietnam was a fairly unpopular war. Many of the surgeons were not really welcomed into professional societies. They were sometimes looked down on as being, you know, not quite as good as people that were in the private world and the civilian world and not in the military. And I learned that from Dr. Norman Rich, who's really quite explicit about his experience coming back from World War II. And so there was an idea that there should be partnerships between military and civilian surgeons to sort of highlight how good the military surgeons are, and they're phenomenal surgeons, but they just don't get the kind of press that sometimes the civilian surgeons get. So that was sort of the beginning of how we started to look at partnerships. And really the spark for us was a program that we developed through the Committee on Trauma at the American College of Surgeons and the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma that allowed us to go as far as Germany during the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. It allowed the civilian surgeons to rotate through there. You generally did it on your vacation time, so 2 to 3 weeks at a time. Over the course of 7 years, we sent 200 civilian surgeons over to Landstuhl, and they would participate in rounds. They got to do the operating room if that was required. They did some teaching, gave some lectures, did some research, and really got to know the military surgeons as partners. And, you know, I think we all went over there thinking, oh, we're going to teach and we're going to do this and do that. And I think all of us came back with saying, wow, we learned so much. So to me, that was a really, really life-changing experience to be able to do that. I personally went there every year for 7 years, and a lot of people were there more than once. So it was really an opportunity for us to learn firsthand what they were doing and to see these injuries, which were incredible, from the people that were flown back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
What year did that program start?
We started in 2006 and we sundowned it in 2013 when the ops tempo went down so low. And it was sponsored financially by the Department of Defense, of course, which allowed us to fly over there and to stay in the military barracks that were there for the doctors. But the American College of Surgeons and the AAST, American Association for Surgery of Trauma, put in money as well to the program.
So in that senior visiting surgeon program, what specialties of surgeons were being used to augment the United States military?
Yeah, so we sent, primarily it went through the trauma world, but we sent trauma surgeons, general surgeons, then the vascular surgeons jumped on board and a bunch of them went over there because there were, as you know, a lot of vascular injuries at that time. We even sent orthopedics. So the Orthopedic Trauma Association sent people over and even a couple neurosurgeons squeaked in. So it was just an incredible experience for, I think, for both of us, both sides.
And how did people get involved? Did they just send in an email and say, I'm interested, or what did they do?
We had a selection committee on the civilian side. We really were careful that we didn't send people over there that were going to kind of take over and think that they were going to direct things. We wanted people that were going to be collaborative with the military. And so we were a little bit selective on who we allowed to go.
So as a visiting professor yourself, you actually did not quite always stop in Launchdual, as in 2008, you actually went to Balad. And according to the website of the American College of Surgeons, you were the only visiting professor that actually went to Balad. So tell us about that experience and what you experienced when you went forward as a civilian surgeon going to Balad.
I mean, everybody wanted to go to see what it was like firsthand, because, as you know, the people that we were treating in Germany had been operated on once or twice, had been resuscitated, and so we didn't see the full picture. And so a lot of us wanted to go. You know, people were saying, can we jump on this plane and go down there? And the answer was no. You guys are a liability. You don't know how to behave in a war zone. You don't have the proper training. And so we kind of gave up on the idea. And then through, I think, lobbying by some of my friends in the military, really, is how I got an invitation. And it came, I was at home and my cell phone rang, and it was somebody at CENTCOM that said, we want you to come and give a few lectures at this chief trauma conference. And I said, well, what would you like me to talk about? And he said, we don't care. It can be any trauma topics that you like, and gave me the dates. And then I was about to hang up the phone and I said, where is this conference? And I was told, it's in Balad, Iraq. I go, oh. And so he said, oh, but you know, it probably is not going to work because we've never done this before. So don't get your hopes up. And then over the course of a week, I started to get some communication. You know, she's got to get her privileges. So let's have her go through Travis. That's close enough to her. And where's she going to billet here and all this stuff? And pretty soon it was pretty clear that I was going to go. So I went over there with Don Jenkins, from San Antonio, as I'm sure you know him, one of the real originators of the whole system in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he met me in Germany, and we stayed over there one night, and then we ended up flying together into Balad. And my only request was that I didn't want to have to get up at night and use a bathroom someplace in the middle of the desert. I said, I have to be someplace where there's running water. And so eventually they took me to a trailer when I got there, and it turned out that it was the vice president's trailer. Of course, he wasn't there, but it was Cheney's trailer. And on one wall was a bunch of stuff. And they said, please don't touch anything on that wall, because it was like, you know, how to call up World War III and all the other things that were on the wall. So I was very careful not to touch anything, but I did have a really nice accommodations and an air-conditioned trailer. And that was, you know, I didn't have to get up in the middle of the night to run through the desert to pee. So that was good for me. So I was there for 10 days. I took call with the guys. I operated every day on whatever they were, you know, whatever they were doing. One of the biggest things I learned while I was there, which I reflected on more recently, was how to manage multi-casualties. Because as you know, there were mass casualties all the time there. And I stood back and watched how they were organized. And I saw the surgeon in charge didn't actually approach the patient. He stood away and watched the whole room and helped to determine who goes where, who needs the operating room now, you know, who went to CT. And that was very, very helpful, because I had my own mass casualty to manage when I was back at San Francisco General, when the plane crash that came, the Asiana plane crash happened, and I happened to be on call. We didn't get any forewarning about that. We got a call from the emergency room and said, oh, there's a cargo plane that crashed at the San Francisco General Airport, and you probably won't hear anything about it. We're just letting you know. And about 5 minutes later, 12 ambulances showed up. All of them had a critical care patient from that crash. And I ran down to the emergency room, and I almost got physically ill. I'm just like, oh my God, I can't do this. And for some reason it clicked in my mind how it had worked in Iraq and had, you know, the person in charge has to stay away and actually direct the traffic. And that really helped me. So I learned a ton when I was down there. One of the most memorable things was there was a death of a U.S. soldier. Almost the whole theater closes down when that happens. And then everybody went to the rooftop of the hospital and did M&M, you know, talked about what could have been differently, what we could have done. And it was the most honest morbidity and mortality conference I've ever heard in my life. So very, very fond memories of going down there, and I was just very fortunate. And then I got to fly with the critical care air transport team on the way back, which was also a phenomenal learning experience for me to see what they could do in the air on these critical patients.
Were there any particular cases that stood out or experiences? Balad was known, I mean, it's an Air Force base, so the accommodations are going to be better than the Army places in there, but it was known for rockets and mortars. Any cases or experiences that stand out to you from that experience?
There was mortar all the time. And you just kind of got used to it. I got to see some very fresh casualties as they came in, which was, you know, remarkable to see. There were a lot of children. I think a lot of the civilian surgeons don't appreciate how much humanitarian work is done by the military. And I was really moved to see all these children. You know, some of them were failure to thrive and would just have to be turned back, which was very sad to see some of those things. We had an electrocution of a child. I remember working on that case with Dr. Rasmussen, and it was a kid that picked up a wire, not recognizing that they had electricity flowing through them because they didn't used to have it. And he got a terrible burn wound, you know, just the typical shock from a burn wound going through your body. That was something I'd never seen before in the United States. Other things that stood out to me, I learned how to do a vascular shunt. This will be of interest to you as a vascular surgeon. I'd never seen one before. We never had an occasion to use them. And then I was, you know, it's not very hard to do, and it's remarkably smart because it just buys you time when time is of the essence on a limb that's devascularized. And I used that when I came back, especially when we had patients in shock and you have a multiple injuries and you can put the shunt in and buys you some time, or you have a combined orthopedic injury and the orthopedic guys always go, oh, it won't take us very long to stabilize that fracture for you, and you know better. You know it's going to take a while. So you put the shunt in and you've got the time, you know, all the leisure time in the world to get your act together. And so those were some of the things that really stood out for me. And I brought those back with me, those lessons.
So you mentioned that you had some experiences that changed your personal individual practice. Like for instance, when you had the mass casualty event from the airplane crash at the San Francisco International Airport. What do you think from a global trauma surgery community were some of the changes in the practice patterns that occurred from the wars that were in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, so I mentioned the shunt. Really damage control damage control surgery was really perfected, you know, because the patients went from maybe a roll one to a roll two to roll three to roll four with different operations done at each setting. And, you know, although we talked a lot about damage control before that in the civilian world, it was nothing like the way the military had to do it. And so, you know, that certainly became our practice. We would leave abdomens open and come back and wash out and then, you know, make sure that we didn't miss an injury. Just really, really, really changed, you know, our perspective on that. Tourniquets were another thing that, you know, were not supposed to be used in the civilian world, and they were not supposed to be on ambulances. They came off, and they were incredibly life-saving in the military. So those came back. As you know, there's a whole program that the college endorses, which is called Stop the Bleed, where we teach high school kids how to put on a tourniquet and how to pack a wound. the resuscitation protocols, initially starting with the work that John Holcomb did, which was called damage control resuscitation, where you're giving blood and platelets and FFP in a one-to-one-to-one fashion. We quickly adopted those in the civilian world as we started to study it. Right now, whole blood resuscitation is coming into the civilian world. That was done with the walking blood banks, as you know, in the military. So those are some of the things that stand out to me that were really very important. And then I guess burn care is another one where, you know, the resuscitation of a burn patient changed dramatically. So we weren't drowning them by giving them a whole lot of salt and making them sicker. So those are the things that really stand out to me from what we've, you know, taken from the military and put it in the civilian world. And the way I look at it is, you know, it's our job to preserve those lessons and then to study them scientifically, which we can do in the civilian world. And it's more difficult to do during combat times. And then they're ready, you know, they've been scientifically validated, and then they can go back into the CPGs of the military. That's the way, that's the whole turnaround, that the way I see it. And that's where the partnerships are very, very important.
So as we enter 2024, clearly the operational tempo of wartime combat casualty care has decreased significantly from the peak when you were there in the early 2000s. And now fewer military medical professionals are getting deployment experience with complex wartime trauma. What are your primary concerns about the United States military ability to provide excellent surgical care on the battlefields of the future?
As I'm sure you're aware, most military surgeons are not trauma surgeons. They don't practice trauma in their garrison practice. The lessons learned and unlearned and having to be relearned again has been recognized for centuries. And it's sometimes called the Walker dip or the peacetime effect. And I just finished reviewing Churchill's original book, and he talks about it as being military surgery as a discontinuous specialty. And he gives a great example of this. He talks about, he said, let's say that all the neurosurgeons in the world decided that they weren't going to do neurosurgery again. And so they would pack up all the instruments, all their operations, and just stop. And then 25 years later, some little boy would come along, a brand new surgeon, and say, oh, I think I want to do neurosurgery. And he would have to go and brush off the books where things were written about neurosurgery and find the instruments and have to start the specialty all over. And he likens that to military surgery, that, you know, in between wars, we tend to forget and then have to relearn, you know, how to do some of these things, which are not particularly new. Damage control resuscitation is not a new idea. Giving whole blood is not a new idea. It's been known for a long time, but it has to be learned and relearned. So the idea between the partnership with the American College of Surgeons was to somehow help to preserve some of those lessons. We've thought very hard about how to do this, and we have a number of steps. The first step is to get the knowledge down. And so we brought together people with war experience and some of the civilians, and we sat in a room for a week, and we wrote down all the things that we thought it was important for a surgeon in the military who's being deployed, what they would need to know. And so we did sort of a building block of things in various categories: abdominal work, vascular work, thoracic work. What did they need to know to be ready for deployment? So that was the knowledge part. And then we talked about the skills part. What operations do you really need to be able to do quickly by yourself, unsupervised, when you're deployed? We put those together as sort of a knowledge assessment and a skills assessment. And then we designed a curriculum to go along with that. And that curriculum is just now available through the college website. It's free. We translated some of the modules into Ukraine so that they could use them. It's a kind of, I call it a tiki-talk kind of a program, because they're very short, 15 to 20 minutes each little module. And it's very helpful for somebody who hasn't done something in a while, or just, you know, like just-in-time learning or preparing for something like an exam, which we haven't really looked at some of that material before. So those are the three components. Then finally, we recognize that you can't really be ready for deployment if you've never really worked in trauma. And so the fourth element really is the development of these military-civilian partnerships, which allow a military surgeon to work in a trauma center for a certain period of time. So those are the four things that we've really worked hard over the last nine, almost 10 years in partnership with the Department of Defense.
The American College of Surgeons, we've actually partnered with them as war docs, and we've gone through several of the modules with hemorrhagic shock. We actually did pediatric surgery trauma, which is out recently. And we also did solid organ injury, where we talked about what to do for the abdomen. But as you talk about that, I sort of think that I reflect back on my own experience, because I helped develop the knowledge, skills, and abilities for vascular surgery. What do you think are the challenges in implementing a system of trauma care between the military and civilian partnerships, particularly for surgeons who maybe have a slightly different than normal trauma practice, like a laparoscopic surgeon, or in a vascular surgery case, it might be a surgeon that primarily focuses on veins or dialysis work, for instance?
Well, not only that, but even in busy vascular fellowships, open surgeries are not very common anymore, right? There's a lot of balloons and wires. Sometimes you have to help the vascular fellow find the femoral artery sometimes in an open case, has been my experience. It's different. I may be differing from some other people in this world, but I really, really truly believe you can't take care of a trauma patient unless you've had that experience firsthand. It's more than just the operating part. A person who does open an abdomen in other areas can get themselves around the abdomen, but trauma is a mentality. The way I used to tell my residents, it's knowing how to go from first gear to five really quickly and when to do it. And there's so much judgment that goes along with taking care of a trauma patient that I just don't think you can teach that unless you've actually experienced it. So I really believe that the partnerships are the way to keep the military surgeons ready for deployment at all times. They're currently under the Mission Zero Act. There are 25 military-civilian partnerships that are being funded now, not completely, but are receiving some funding through Mission Zero. And we worked really hard on the civilian side to get Mission Zero funded. You know, it's been in existence, the idea, since 2017 as part of the NDAA, but it didn't get funded until last year, 2022. It's taken a lot of lobbying on the part of our people in Washington. I've gone myself to give some congressional briefs. This is, I believe, the future is these partnerships, developing them, making sure that they're performing in the way that we would want them to perform. At the college, again, through a long process, we composed what we call the Blue Book, which is designed to help put up a military-civilian partnership with all the components. It's kind of like the Committee on Trauma's verification book, has suggestions on how to do it, quality markers, and we haven't done the site visits yet, but that's the next part of the program, is we want to visit some of these partnerships to see if there are best practices that we can identify, help out with things that are not going smoothly, and take from some of the great performance ones to some that are maybe having trouble. So that's really the next part of this partnership.
So I think it's absolutely fabulous what the American College of Surgeons is doing to help prepare and maintain the skills of military surgeons. One of the questions I had is, in the next war with a large-scale combat operation, multi-domain operation, there may be more casualties than military physicians and healthcare professionals can handle. And the civilian community in America may be called up either in a draft or to augment that. Is the American College of Surgeons thinking of what do we do in that case? And are the surgeons prepared to step up and take care of that kind of trauma?
Yeah, I think you would see, just as we saw people that wanted to go to Germany and even further down, I think you'd see the trauma community step up in a big way. One of the things with the military-civilian partnerships that are funded through Mission Zero is they have to be part of NDMS. So that at least identifies places where casualties could be sent in a larger scale operations, because all of the military surgeons will be gone. And so the civilian, at least trauma centers, will be prepared to accept casualties. That's stage one. But I think you would find many, many trauma surgeons on the civilian side that would be happy to go over and serve in a large-scale operations. I think we found that when we started to look at people going as far as Germany. Many people wanted to go further. I think the trauma community is ready. You know, trauma has always been around, but it hasn't been a specialty for that many years. And one of the things about trauma that attracted me, you could write something that was new. You know, we wrote about how not to operate on livers. One of my very first national papers that I ever gave, and I almost got crucified by one of my former instructors at Michigan. Told me, I thought we taught you how to operate. And I said, yes, but we don't, you know, some of these liver injuries, we make them worse when we operate on them. And maybe we don't need to operate on all of those. And, you know, that was a new concept, but you could do a lot as a young trauma surgeon, because it wasn't considered a specialty really until we put critical care into it. And then trauma became more and more of a specialty. And now, of course, it's got multiple organizations, East, West, AAST, Committee on Trauma, lots and lots of trauma surgeons. But I don't think you'd have a problem. The problem would be finding us. You know, finding who's ready to go, who's, you know, we would have to get some training to make us ready. But I don't think you would have a problem getting people to go.
So for our listeners out there that are listening to this and thinking to themselves, well, what exactly is this military-civilian partnership that they keep talking about? I'm going to briefly tell them, at least from an active duty side, like what it is that we're talking about from someone who has some familiarity with these systems. So the military-civilian partnerships that we've just now been talking about are ones in which an active duty salaried physician is placed into a trauma center within the United States. And the ones that come to mind are Cooper, Baltimore Shock Trauma, University of Washington. And those are just three of the 25 that you mentioned. There's also training agreements where a military surgeon who works in a local area may actually partner with a university. The institution's partner and the military surgeon works at the civilian university. That's a little bit different than what we're talking about here today. But when you have these embedded surgeons for the first group that I described, where they're actually stationed and assigned to a civilian institution, what have been the challenges that the institutions have faced when having these types of surgeons that, as they listen to this, they may say, well, yes, it's great to have someone who's already salaried here, but there's got to be some challenges that that they would face.
That's one of the things that we've discussed quite a bit when we put together the Blue Book. Just remember that the partnerships are not just for surgeons. Some of them have full teams. For instance, the new one that's at the University of Pennsylvania has 11 people on their exchange. So it's nurses, it's sometimes emergency medicine, sometimes orthopedic, depending. It's not just the surgeons themselves. Some of the challenges have been to do with billing, sometimes malpractice. Licensing is a big thing, because you don't want somebody to have to get a whole new license to rotate, say, through San Francisco General Hospital, have to get a California license just for that. Sometimes there's competition. For instance, if you have a person who's coming in and you have multiple trauma fellows, and, you know, there's cases that might go to the military surgeons and not to some of the other fellows. So that's something that we're very concerned about, you know, the effect on GME of the civilian side. Having people get deployed and taken out say you're on, you've got a schedule and you've got the military surgeon taking call like once a week, you know, what happens when that person gets deployed? So those are some of the issues that I think all of the partnerships are facing, which is again why we want to start this new program of actually going in and looking at some of these partnerships in depth, and so that we get a better idea of some of the best practices, how some of these ideas have been resolved. The first five, the big five, started really in the early 2000s. And that was St. Louis for the Air Force, Cincinnati for the Air Force, Baltimore Shock Trauma for the Air Force, at Ryder for the Army, and then the Navy, San Diego, I think, for the Navy partnerships. So those were the first five. And so now, as I mentioned, we have 25. And some of those have what they call cadre, as I'm sure you're aware of, where people stay there for a longer period of time, not just rotating through, but staying for 2 to 3 years as a permanent site. No, the Navy, I'm sorry, goes to USC, Southern California.
In San Antonio, where we both are currently, we have a unique trauma situation where the military, Brooke Army Medical Center, and before we had Wilford Hall Air Force Military Center and UT Health all combined to have a combined trauma system for the city of San Antonio and surrounding areas. Where do you see these MilSIV partnerships like the ACS is working on evolving in the next 10 years? And do you see any other opportunities for the military to join in communities and offer trauma services within their own hospitals?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal, right? San Antonio is the gold standard for, you know, it's the only level one in the military system. And there are lots of areas where military facilities could be very useful if they were trauma ready. Lots of the areas where there's, you know, there's many areas of the country where a person can't get to a level one trauma center within an hour. But there might be military hospitals that could ramp up and serve those areas. We're very civilian oriented, I guess, with these partnerships, but there's nothing to say that a military hospital couldn't become a trauma center, and hopefully some of them will. So again, that would allow the military surgeons and the teams to have continuous training in trauma by going through the designation process.
Are there other programs within the American College of Surgeons that are aimed at improving trauma and surgical care that might be of interest to our listeners?
The first verification programs were in trauma, obviously, that we've been talking about, but the American College of Surgeons has a philosophy of setting the standards and then verifying that those standards are being met and collecting the data. And so after trauma, the quality officers at the ACS, it's a very large division, started to put together criteria for bariatric surgery. There's criteria for pediatric surgery. Vascular surgery has its own program now. Oncology has its own program. And so there are various books that are written about what you need to be a designated bariatric center or a vascular center of high. In fact, UCSF just went through their vascular designation process. You can actually go through a process just for quality itself. We'll come in and look at your quality officer and how you're doing your PI and your feedback loops and what kind of programs that you have in place. The college is very experienced at doing that. Trauma led the way, I'm proud to say. But there's a number of programs that the college is now offering to help keep the quality of surgical care high.
What words of advice would you give to our military medical professionals that are listening based on your decade or more of leadership in these military strategic partnerships, or just in general about, you know, pursuing careers in trauma, pediatric surgery, or all the things that you have experience in?
You know, it's obvious that not all military surgeons are going to be trauma surgeons because they have to work in areas that are, you know, other areas that are in need. One of the things I'm the most proud of about what we did at the college was to establish this group, the Excelsior Surgical Society. And the history of that is that after World War II, the surgeons who had been deployed, including Dr. Churchill, met at the Excelsior Hotel in Rome in 1946, and they compared their experience as during the war. And that started this Excelsior Club, initially it was called, and they met for many years until the last living member of that club died in the 1980s, and that was actually Dr. DeBakey. In the later part of the 80s, the Churchill lecture and the idea of Excelsior came to the college, and they established a yearly lecture with the sponsorship from the original Excelsior Club. So money went into the foundation to pay for a yearly lecture. What we did at the college was to basically start the Excelsior Surgical Society again. It now has almost 500 military members, including military residents, fellows, active duty, retired, and we're starting now to do international members. It's, you know, it's a great, great organization. Has a full day of lectures and workshops during the clinical congress. Now it's officially part of the program. It has a monthly webinar. The last one we just did last week was on burn care. It was amazing. It has a number of committees, including scholarship committees to look at research, membership committees, program committees. So I would encourage anybody in the military to become a member of Excelsior. It's your personal professional group now, so that you have a permanent home.
We've been speaking with Dr. Peggy Knutson on War Docs Podcast. Peggy, thanks again for sharing your experiences and insights with us. And thank you for what you're doing to improve surgical trauma care and your work with the American College of Surgeons and the Excelsior Surgical Society.
Great to meet you both.
Thank you for listening to War Docs. We sure hope you enjoyed it. War Docs is a nonprofit organization supported by donations from listeners like you. Please follow and subscribe to our show on whatever platform you consume your podcasts, and rate and review this episode, and share the show with your contacts on social media. Find out more information about our show, our guests, and how to become a member of Team War Docs on wardocspodcast.com. Thank you for your support. If you like war stories and medical drama, War Docs has you covered. Spread the word.